matter of routine, just to see if you did anything out of the ordinary. And you did. So, what does Ramirez do now?
I'll buy it, I said.
What does he do?
He lays Kane alongside you again, said Campbell.
You gave him the perfect opportunity. You practically invited Kane to come back. It's Kane's job to find out what, if anything, is in the wind. But what Ramirez doesn't know is that you were suspicious of Kane right from the start, and this gives us a perfect opportunity. We string Kane along, employ him, feed him any information we want him to know, and keep from him anything we don't want him to know. We also keep him underfoot and don't lose him again. That's why you mustn't ask him any awkward questions. Not right now, anyway.
I thought about it for a long time.
Does this mean you're coming in with us, putting up the finance?
You're damn right it does, snapped Campbell.
If Suarez Navarro are going to all this trouble, they must be onto something big, and I'd like to stab them in the back, just for old time's sake. I'll put up $500,000, or whatever it takes, and I ask only one thing, that we get there, and do it, before they can.
Geordi said gently,
It was a good idea of mine, wasn't it?
What's that? Asked Campbell.
Geordi's recruiting a private army, I explained. As he gets older, he gets more bloodthirsty.
A look passed between them for the second time, that made me feel like the outsider. Without saying a word, they were in full accord on many levels, and for a moment I felt very inexperienced indeed. Campbell said,
There's another thing. My doctor is troubled about my health, the goddamn quack. He's been pestering me to take a sea voyage, and I'm suddenly minded to accept his advice. I'm coming along for the ride.
You're the boss, I said.
I wasn't surprised.
He turned to Geordi.
Now, what kind of a ship have you, Captain?
A brigantine, said Geordi. About 200 tons.
Campbell's jaw dropped.
But that's a little sailing ship. This is supposed to be a serious project.
Take it easy, I said,
grinning at Geordi, who was already bristling at any slight to Esmeralda. A lot of research vessels are sailing ships. They happen to be a number of sound reasons.
All right, let's hear them.
Well, some of the reasons are purely technical, I said.
For instance, it's easier to make a sailing ship non-magnetic than a powered ship.
Magnetism plays hell with all sorts of important readings, but the reasons you'll appreciate are purely economic.
If you're talking economics, you're talking my language, he growled.
A research ship never knows exactly where it's going. We might find ourselves dredging 1,000 miles away from the nearest land. Station keeping and dredging takes power and fuel, and an engine-powered ship would need a hell of a lot of fuel to make the round trip.
But a sailing ship can make the journey and arrive on station with close-on full tanks, given careful management. She can keep on station longer, and no one need worry about whether there'll be enough fuel to get back. You could use a powered ship to do the job, but it would cost you, £1,000,000+.
Geordi's boat will be fine.
The day's not been wasted, Campbell said.
I've learned something new.
I reckon you know your job, Trevelyan. What will you need in the way of equipment?
So we got down to it.
The biggest item was the winch, which was to be installed amidships, and storage space for 30,000 feet of cable below it. There was also to be a laboratory for on-the-spot analysis, and all the necessary equipment would take a lot of money and a lot of refitting.
We'll need a bloody big generator for this lot, said Geordi.
It looks as though it'll take a diesel bigger than the main engine.
Lucky, isn't it, that charter tourists take up so much space with luxuries.
Presently, Campbell suggested lunch, so we went down to the dining room to do some more planning over grilled steaks. It was arranged that I should concentrate on collecting equipment while Geordi prepared Esmeralda and got his crew together. Very little was said concerning the location, or the availability of the strange treasure we were after, and I knew that I alone could come up with anything of use there. I had some heavy studying ahead of me, as well as all the rest.
"If you take on Cain, it'll mean we've got him in our sights," said Campbell, harping back to his favourite subject. "Not that it makes any difference. Ramirez is sure to have other scouts out. I'll be watching him, too."
I'd been thinking about Cain. "Your review of the situation was very well in its way, but it was wrong on one point."
"What's that?" said Campbell.
"You said that Cain spun me a yarn as cover, and that it didn't matter what it was. Well, that's not entirely so, you know. We have independent evidence. The death certificate states the cause of death as appendicitis. Cain and Shouten both told the same lie, and I'd like to know why."
"By God, you're right," said Campbell. "We'll get it out of Cain as soon as he's served his purpose."
Geordie grunted.
"We're going into the Pacific," he said. "Maybe we'll get it out of Shouten. At all events, we'll be at the root of it."
3. It was nearly 3 months before we got away. You can't begin a scientific expedition as though you were going on a picnic. There were a million things to do, and we were kept busy on a 16-hour day, 7 days a week. The first thing I did was to hand in my resignation from the Institute. Old Jarvis didn't take it too well, but there wasn't anything he could do about it, so he accepted the situation with reluctance. I wished I could have told him what I was doing, but that was impossible. Geordie assiduously recruited his crew, and soon they began to turn up. He had kept on 4 of his own lads, and had, of course, taken on Cain in place of one of the men he let go. Of the other 6 that he added, all were faces that I hadn't seen since I had been a boy during the war, tagging around after my dad's gang. Ian Lewis detached himself from his croft with alacrity, and Geordie made him first mate. He'd had years under sail, and was almost as good as a professional. Ex-corporal Tuffy Morgan came along. One night during the war, he had killed 6 Germans with a commando knife in utter silence, earning himself the MM. Danny Williams had also won the MM, although I never found out what for, since he was reticent about it. There was the burly bulk of Nick Duggan, an Irishman from the Free State. Bill Hunter turned up. He had made a name for himself as an underwater demolitions expert, and was the only other regular sailing man among the team. And there was Jim Taylor, another explosives wizard. He had been very near my father when he was killed. They were now all into their 40s, like Geordie, but seemed as tough as ever. Not one had lost his fitness, and there wasn't a paunch among the lot of them. Geordie said he could have recruited 25, but he'd picked the best of them, and I almost believed him. I was confident that if we ran into trouble, we could handle it. Geordie was confident, too, of wielding them into a good sailing crew. What any of them lacked in knowledge, they'd soon pick up, and the enthusiasm was certainly there, although, for the time being, they knew nothing of the complications in which we were entangled. It was a straight research and survey trip to them all, including Cain, and any hints Geordie may have given his special team, they kept strictly to themselves. As Campbell had predicted, Cain was sticking as close to us as a leech. Geordie had simply told him that there was a berth for him, if he cared to cross the Atlantic with us, and Cain had jumped at the opportunity. Campbell had gone back to Canada. Before he left, he had a long talk with me. "I told you I had a good intelligence service," he said. "Well, so have Suarez Navarro. You'll be watched, and they'll know everything you do as soon as you do it, even apart from Cain's spying. It can't be helped. We're deadlocked and we know it. So do they." It's a case of we know that they know that we know, and so on. It's a bastard of a position to be in. It's like a game with perfect information. Chess, for example. It's the man who can maneuver best who wins. Not quite. Both sides have imperfect information. He corrected me, patiently. We don't know how much they really know. They might have the exact location of the nodules we're after, and only have to drop a dredge to prove their case. But perhaps they're behind us in planning, and need to stop us somehow first. On the other hand, they don't know how much we know, which is precious little. Maybe as much as, or no more than them. Tricky, isn't it? It would take a logician to sort it out. Talking of knowing, have you made any progress with the diary? Campbell snorted. I gave it to a top-flight cipher expert, and he's having his troubles. He says it isn't so much the peculiar shorthand as the sloppy way in which it's written, but he says he can crack it, given time. What I wish I knew was how Suarez Navarro got onto this in the first place. My own thoughts were that Mark cheated out of Campbell's involvement. I guess that's how he would see Campbell's loss, only in terms of his own disappointment, had approached them himself. But I still didn't know enough about how Campbell viewed Mark to say so. It hung between us, a touchy subject that we both carefully avoided. So he went off to Canada to further his own progress. We speeded up ours as much as possible, and it was with great relief that I heard Geordie announce one day that we were at last ready for sea. All he needed to know was where to head for. I said, "Do you know the Blake Plateau?" "Never heard of it." "It's just off the coast of Carolina. We'll test the winch and the rest of our gear there, and it's a long enough voyage for you to pull your crew together. I don't want to go into the Pacific to find that anything doesn't work for some reason or other. If there's anything wrong, we can get it fixed in Panama. They've got good engineering shops there." "Okay, but why the Blake Plateau?" "There are nodules there. I've always wanted a closer look at Atlantic nodules." "Is there any place where there aren't any?" he asked. I nodded. "They won't form where there's heavy sedimentation, so that cuts out most of the Atlantic. But the Blake Plateau is scoured by the Gulf Stream, and nodules do form, but they're poor quality, not like the ones in the Pacific." "How deep?" "Not more than 3,000 feet. Deep enough to test the winch." "Right, boy. Let's go and scoop up some poor quality well from the bottom of the sea. We shall be away in a few days now." "I can't wait," I said. I was, in fact, boiling with impatience to be gone. 2. We made a fair and untroubled crossing of the Atlantic. Geordie and Ian, together with the regular crew members, soon got the others into a good working pattern, and spirits ran high. Kane, we were pleased to notice, fitted in well, and seemed as willing and above board as the others. Knowing that they were all curious as to our purpose, I gave occasional, rather deliberately boring lectures on oceanography, touching on a number of possible research subjects, so that the matter of manganese nodules got lost in the general subject. Only 2 people retained an interest in what I had to say, and to them, in semi-private, I spoke at great length about our quarry. One was Geordie, of course, and the other, not too surprisingly, and in fact to my satisfaction, was Bill Hunter. Already our diving expert, his interest and involvement might well be crucial. One afternoon, they both joined me in the laboratory, at my request, to learn a little more. A quiet word from Geordie to Ian made sure that we weren't going to be interrupted. Geordie picked up a nodule, which I'd cut in half. I'd brought a few on board to help my explanation along. He pointed to the white central core. "I suppose you'll tell me again that it's a shark's tooth in the middle of this rock. You never did get around to explaining that, did you?" I smiled and held up the stone.
That's right, it is.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not.
It happens often. You see, a shark dies and its body drifts down. The flesh rots or is eaten. The bones dissolve. What bones a shark has, it's cartilage, really. And by the time anything reaches the very bottom, there's nothing left but the teeth. They are made of sodium triphosphate and insoluble in water. There are probably millions of them on any ocean bottom. I opened a small box.
Look here, I said,
and gave him a larger white bone. It was as big as the palm of his hand and curiously convoluted.
What's this?
It's a whale's ear bone, said Bill, looking over his shoulder. I've seen 'em before.
Right, Bill. Also made of sodium triphosphate. We sometimes find them at the core of larger nodules, but more often it's a shark's tooth and, most frequently, a bit of clay.
So the manganese sticks to the tooth. How long does it take to make a nodule? Geordie asked.
Estimates vary from 1 millimetre each 1,000 years to 1 millimetre each 1,000,000 years. One chap estimated that it worked out to 1 layer of atoms a day, which makes it one of the slowest chemical reactions known. But I have my own ideas about that.
They both stared at me.
Do you mean that if you found a nodule with a half diameter of 10 millimetres, formed around a tooth that the shark lived 10 million years ago?
Were there sharks then? Geordie asked in fascination.
Oh, yes. The shark is one of our oldest inhabitants.
We talked a little more, and then I dropped it. They had a lot to learn yet, and it came best in small doses, and there was plenty of time for talk on this voyage. We headed south-southwest to cut through the Bahamas and the approach to the Windward Passage. Once in the passage, we kept as clear as possible of Cuba. Once we came across an American destroyer on patrol, which did us the courtesy of dipping her flag, to which we reciprocated. Then there was the long leg across the Caribbean to Colon and the entrance to the Panama Canal. By then, we had done our testing. There were minor problems, no more than teething troubles, and generally I was happy with the way things were going. Stopping to dredge a little, trying out the winch and working out on-station routines was an interesting change from what we had been doing, and everyone enjoyed it, and we remained lucky with the weather. I got some nodules up, but there was a lot of other material, enough to cloud the issue for everyone but Geordie. Among the debris of ooze, red clay and deposits, we found enough shark's teeth and whale's ear bone to give everyone on board a handful of souvenirs. Both Geordie and Bill were becoming more and more interested in the nodules and wanted to know more about them, so I arranged for another lab session with them one day. I'd been assaying, partly to keep my hand in, and partly to check on the readiness of my equipment for the real thing.
How did the Atlantic nodules turn out? Geordie asked.
On the whole, he did the talking. Bill watched, listened, and absorbed.
Same old low-quality stuff that's always pulled out in the Atlantic, I said. Low manganese, low iron, and hardly anything else except contaminants, clay and such like. That's the trouble in the Atlantic. There's too much sediment, even on the Blake Plateau.
Why does manganese behave this way? Why does it lump together?
I laughed. You want me to give you a course of physical chemistry right now? All right, I'll explain it as simply as I can. Do you know what a colloid is?
Two head shakes.
Look. If you put a teaspoon of sugar into water, you get a sugar solution. That is, the sugar breaks down right to the molecular level and mixes intimately with the water. In other words, it dissolves, right?
Right.
Now,
What if you have a substance that won't dissolve in water but is divided into very fine particles, much smaller than can be seen in a regular microscope, and each particle is floating in the water? That's a colloid. I could whip you up a colloid which looks like a clear liquid, but it would be full of very small particles.
I see the difference, Geordie said.
All right. Now, for reasons that I won't go into now, all colloidal particles must carry an electric charge. These charges make the colloidal particles of manganese dioxide clump together in larger and larger units. They also tend to be attracted to any electrically conductive surfaces, such as a shark's tooth or a bit of clay. Hence, the nodules.
You mean, said Bill slowly, that having broken down a long time before, the manganese is trying to get together again?
Oh, pretty well just that, yes.
Where does the manganese come from in the first place? When it starts clumping, that is.
From the rivers, from underground volcanic fissures, from the rocks of the sea bottom. Fellas, the sea out there is a big chemical broth. In certain localized conditions, the sea becomes alkaline, and the manganese in the rocks leaches out and dissolves in the water.
You said it doesn't dissolve.
Pure metallic manganese will dissolve, as long as the conditions are right, and that's what chemists call a reducing atmosphere. Just believe me, Geordie. Currents carry the dissolved manganese into oxidizing atmosphere, where the water is more acid. The manganese combines with oxygen to form manganese dioxide, which is insoluble, and so forms a colloid. And then the process goes on, as I've described. He thought about that.
What about the copper and nickel and cobalt and stuff that's in the nodules?
How does the milk get into the coconut?
We all laughed,
taking some of the schoolroom air out of the lab.
Well, all these metals have certain affinities for each other. If you look at the table of elements, you'll find they're grouped closely together by weight, from manganese, number 25, to copper, number 29. What happens is that as the colloidal particles grow bigger, they scavenge the other metals, entrap them. Now, of course, this is happening over a pretty long period of time.
Say 100 million years or so, said Geordie, ironically.
Ah, well, that's the orthodox view.
You think it can happen faster than that?
I think it could happen fast, I said slowly, given the right conditions. Though just what these conditions would be, I'm not sure. Someone else doing research thought so too, though I haven't been able to follow his reasoning, and I have seen peculiarities that indicate rapid growth. Anyway, that's one of the objects of this trip, to find out. What I didn't say in Bill's hearing was that the somebody was Mark, nor that the peculiarities I had seen were contained in the prize nodule left from his collection. And there was something else I didn't talk about. The peculiarities that led to high cobalt assay. I was beginning to grope towards a theory of nodule formation, which, though still vague, might ease the way ahead. I was becoming anxious to know how Campbell's cipher expert had made out in translating Mark's diary. 3. 10 days after leaving the Blake Plateau, we warped into the dockside at Panama. At last, we were in the Pacific, all my goals a step nearer. Campbell was waiting for us, jumped spryly aboard, and shook hands with me and Geordie, waving genially at the rest of the crew.
"You made a good fast trip," he said.
"Not so bad," said Geordie, complacently.
Campbell looked about the Esmeralda and at the crew, who were busy stowing sail and clearing the decks.
"So,
"This is your crew of cutthroats and desperados," he said. He was in a jocular mood, a mercurial man. "I hope we won't need them." He took my arm and walked me along the dock, amused at my wobbling land legs. "I've booked you into my hotel for a night or so. There's no reason why you shouldn't have a last taste of luxury before the big job. Geordie, too, if he wants it. I'll expect you both to dinner. You can't miss the hotel. It's the Colombo, right on the main street. You can tell me all about the trip then. Meantime, I want to talk to you in private now." He steered me into one of the waterfront bars that always seemed to be handy, and I sat down, thankfully, in front of a large glass of cold beer. Campbell wasted no time. He produced a biggish envelope from his jacket. "I had photostats made of the diary pages," he said. "The originals in a bank vault in Montreal. You don't mind? You'll get it back one day." "Not at all," I said. He shook out the contents of the envelope. "I got the translation done. My guy said it was a bastard of a job. He only hopes he's got the scientific bits right. We'll soon find out." I was stiff with eagerness. Campbell handed me a neatly bound booklet, which I flicked through. "That's the stat of the original diary. This one's the translation. There are reproductions of all the drawings at the back. The whole thing looks screwy to me. It'd better make sense to you, or this whole thing is a bust already." His good humour had already evaporated, but I was getting used to his changes of mood. I glanced through it all. "Well, this is going to be a long job," I said. "I'm not going to be able to make any snap judgments here and now. I'll look at this lot this afternoon in the hotel room. Right now, I want to go back to Esmeralda and sort out procedures with Geordie, pack my gear and go and take a shower and a clean up." If he was disappointed, he didn't show it. Clearly, what I said made sense. And so it was not until I was lying, damp and half-naked, in the blessedly cool hotel room a couple of hours later, that I finally opened the envelope. The translation of the cipher was pretty well complete, except for a few gaps here and there, but it didn't improve matters as much as I'd hoped. The thing was disappointingly written in a kind of telegraphese, which didn't make for easy reading. It was a true diary, and evidently covered the last few months of Mark's life, from about the time he left the IGY, although there were a few dates and no place names written in clear at all. I wondered if he'd always kept such a diary, and decided that he must have done so. Diary keeping is a habit as hard to break as to develop. As to where the earlier volumes had got to, there was no guessing, nor did I think they would have helped me much anyway. This was the vital period. It was, on the whole, an ordinary enough diary. There were references to shore leave, films seen, people mentioned by initials, only in the irritating way that people have when confiding to themselves, and all the other trivia of a man's life, all in brusque lack of detail. Mark had kept a brief record of his amours, which wasn't pleasant to read, but otherwise it was fairly uninteresting on the surface. Then there were the entries made at sea. Here the diary turned professional with notes of observations, odd equations roughly jotted, analysis of bottom material, mostly sea ooze. Occasionally there were analyses of nodules, nothing very startling, just run-of-the-sea stuff. I waded on feeling that I might be wasting my time, but towards the end I was pulled up with a start. I had run my eye down the typewritten sheet, and was aware that I was at last looking at something remarkable. It was an analysis of a nodule, though it didn't specifically say so, and the figures were startling. Translated from symbols, they read: manganese, 28%, iron, 32%, cobalt, 8%, copper, 4%, nickel, 6%, other, 22%. Wow. Wow, indeed. There followed analysis of four more nodules, all equally rich. I did some calculating and found the average cobalt in the five nodules to be a fraction under 9%. The copper and nickel weren't to be left away either. I didn't yet know much about the economics of recovery, but it was evident that this might be a paying proposition, even with relatively primitive methods of dredging, depending on the depth of water. And I had reason to believe that this was not too great to be worked in. With more sophisticated equipment, it would be better than owning a gold mine. But there was always the snag. Nowhere in the diary did Mark say where these riches were to be found. In the whole notebook, there was not one place name mentioned, so we weren't really any better off than we were before, except that scattered through the typewritten pages was the phrase, "Picture here," with a number attached, and at the end was a sheaf of reproductions and a brief account by the cipher expert of these doodle drawings. It is possible, and indeed probable, that these drawings are of the nature of pictograms or rebuses. A study of the pictograms leads me to believe that they must indicate place names. And of the 32 drawings, I believe I have successfully identified 24. To illustrate, the rough sketch of the gas mantle with the word "gratis" beneath may well refer to the Australian town of Fremantle. The bearded man with the sword and the baby is probably Solomon, referring to the biblical story, and may indicate the Solomon Islands. The bearded man looking at a monkey may be a reference to Darwin in the Australian Territory. The straight line, neatly bisected, may refer to either the equator or Midway Island. The fact that all these names occur in the same quarter of the globe is a further indication that one may be on the right track in such surmising. Other names, tentatively identified, are also to be found in the same geographical area. Tracings of the drawings together with possible identifications are attached. Of the 8 drawings unidentified, all I can say is that to solve these, one would need to have a more precise knowledge of these geographical areas, together with a need to know a great deal more about the artist, since it is obvious that an idiosyncratic mode of thought is here employed, involving a person's training, experience, and interior feelings. In fact, a total life. I looked up the analysis of the 2 non-standard nodules again. Coming immediately after them were 2 of the drawings, numbers 28 and 29. I checked them against the tracings. One was of a busty wench, wearing a Phrygian cap, with underneath it the words, "The Fair Goddess." The other was a rather bedraggled-looking American eagle, with the inscription, "The Disappearing Trick." Neither was identified. I leaned back and thought about it all. I knew that Mark's ship had been based on Australia during the IGY, hence possibly the Australian references. Mark had probably been in the Solomons and might well have gone as far as Midway. He would certainly have crossed the equator anyway. Did he go as far as Easter Island? I checked the tracings and found it. A rabbit apparently trying to hatch an egg, the traditional fertility symbols of Easter. Well, that was one the expert had spotted too. It was a hell of a big area in which to find the Fair Goddess or the Disappearing Trick. I thought about Mark and his idiosyncratic mode of thought. The expert had been dead right there. Mark's mode of thought had been so damned idiosyncratic that there had been times when I thought it wasn't human. He had a strangely twisted, involute mind, which delighted in complexity and deception, never taking a straight course, but always heading ultimately for one goal, the eventual well-being of Mark Trevelyan. All my life I had watched him cheat and scheme his way towards the things he wanted, never realizing that if he'd gone about his business in a straightforward way, it would have been more efficient. He had a first-class brain, but he was lazy, and always looking for shortcuts, but you don't find many shortcuts in science, and thus he tended to lag behind in his work. I think he was envious of me for some odd reason of his own. I was 2 years older than he, and when we were children, he nearly beat himself to death trying to keep up, physically and mentally. The psycho boys have a term for it in their tasteless jargon, sibling rivalry. But with Mark, it took an unhealthy turn. He seemed to see his whole life in terms of competition with me, even inventing apparent parental favouritism towards me, where I could see none. The only reason that I know for his having elected to study oceanography was because I had done so, and not, like me, out of any burning interest in the subject. He once said that he would be famous when I had been forgotten. It was ironic, in a way, that he should have said that, because he had the makings of a first-rate scientist, with a theoretical bent, and if he'd lived, I'm sure he could have surprised us all, provided he wasn't looking for a shortcut at the time. For years, I'd avoided him, physically and professionally, but now I had to match my mind against his. I had to ferret out the meanings of his cryptic scrawls, and it wasn't going to be easy. Mark had almost certainly been up to something fishy. No high cobalt results had come out of the IGY investigations, and Mark had such results. I thought about what Jarvis had said about Mark faking figures during that period, and about Mark trying to persuade Campbell into an expedition to look for nodules. It was beginning to add up. I was interrupted by Geordie banging at my bedroom door. "Aren't you ready yet?" he demanded. "We got a dinner date with a boss." Oh, my God, the time slipped away. "Found anything?" I looked up wryly. "Yes, I found something, but I'm damned if I know what it is. It looks as though we still have to play children's games against Mark's tortuous mind. I'll tell you about it when we're all together. Give me 10 minutes to get dressed." "There's just one thing first," Geordie said, hovering in the doorway. "Kane went ashore and sent a cable." "Where to?" "We were lucky. I detailed Danny Williams to trail him. Don't worry, he'll keep it dark. And he managed to hear Kane asking about cable rates to Rabaul." "Rabaul? Well, that's in New Britain. In the Bismarck Archipelago. Why in hell would he send a cable clear across the Pacific?" "Do you know who he sent it to?" "Danny couldn't find that out. He should have bribed the counter clerk, but he didn't. The boss says come to the lounge first. It's early for a meal. He wants to talk to us there. About that, I guess." He pointed to the diary pages lying on my bed. 4. The Columbo was a modern American-style hotel. We went to the reception desk where I had signed in earlier and asked for Campbell, and were told that he was in one of the lounges. It was discreetly lighted, and in one corner a trio was playing soft music. It was all very civilized and pleasant, and a definite change from life on board Esmeralda. Over drinks, I asked Campbell to bear with me in setting aside for the moment the matter of the diary, and instead listen while I brought him up to date concerning manganese nodules, to which he reluctantly agreed. He was at his most churlish, but I knew that mood would wear off as his interest sharpened. He had already done some homework, so I was able to cover the matter of nodule formation and distribution fairly quickly, feeling pleased that I had already brought Geordie up to that point as well. I came, at last, to the matter of nodule dating. "I've come to the conclusion that our nodule isn't very old," I said, producing it from my pocket. "How old?" Campbell demanded. "He always talks in millions," said Geordie, wisely. But he was wrong. "Not more than 50,000 years, I said flatly. "It could be between 30,000 and 50,000, but not more than that. I'll stake my reputation on it. Somewhere in the Pacific, these things are growing at an explosive rate." "Explosive?" said Geordie, incredulously. Do you call 50,000 years explosive? Oh, from a geological standpoint, it's very fast. It's damned unusual, though, and it's very important.
Why so? Campbell asked.
Look, the whole damn Pacific is covered with these things, which have been growing slowly over millions of years. Now, we have one which has grown in a fraction of that time. There must be a specific reason for it. My guess is that it's the result of a purely local condition, and if it is, the chances are that this condition still exists. In other words, these nodules are growing at the same rate, even now. I can't see that that helps us much. It helps us this much. It means we can cut out vast areas, millions of square miles, where I know that no peculiar conditions exist in the sea. I'll go along with orthodoxy on that one. The seabed is pretty regular. There are few changes of climate, for one thing. What we've got to watch for is the oddity. Got any idea what kind of oddity? I nodded. I have vague ideas that I'm not prepared to put into words just yet, I said. Maybe I'll get something from the diary translation. It may only need one word to make the whole picture clear, like the last piece in a jigsaw puzzle. We'll come back to that later, Campbell said. Meanwhile, I've been keeping tabs on Suarez Navarro. Ramirez left London and joined that ship of theirs.
Where are they now?
Geordi asked. Still lying in Darwin, doing nothing. I don't quite get it. He glanced up as he spoke, and then got to his feet. Coming through the lounge towards us was a young woman, whom I recognised as his daughter, and Geordi and I both stood up as she joined us. Campbell introduced us. Claire, this is Michael Trevelyan, and this is our captain, George Wilkins. Geordi shook hands gravely and corrected his name. As I took her hand, she looked at me very carefully, but did not react to my name at all. I was on the point of reminding her that I had met her once long before, with Mark, but took my cue from her and made my greeting non-committal. We all sat down once again, and during the few minutes while drinks were being ordered, I assessed her, as a man assesses any woman. When I had seen her in Vancouver, I hadn't been particularly interested. I couldn't be bothered with Mark or any of his affairs. But now I saw that she was really beautiful, and wondered why I hadn't noticed it before. She was tall, with black hair and straight brows over grey eyes. Her mouth was generous, with mobile corners. A mouth made for laughter, but presently in tight control, as though she had learned not to laugh. She was dressed with that deceptive simplicity, which means money. Not surprising, considering that she was Campbell's daughter. She wore, I noticed, no jewellery, apart from a small ruby brooch. We all chatted for a short time about this and that, and I saw that there was something wary and watchful about her, and felt that it concerned me. I wondered how Mark had got on with her. When I saw her with him, she had seemed to have a lot more sparkle, and this present introversion wasn't Mark's style at all. He always liked his women to have some animation. Presently, Campbell brought us to the matter in the forefront of all our minds. I was not altogether surprised when he said, "Gentlemen, you would better know that I have told the whole story, so far as I can, to Claire. She's my right hand, you know, doubles as secretary sometimes, and she's always been involved in my affairs. This one is no different." I thought that burglary, forgery, espionage, and murder would certainly make it different in my eyes, but perhaps she'd seen all that already, on other missions with her father. "What more, when I join ship, she's coming along as well," he continued. He was the boss, after all, but he seemed just a little truculent as he said it, as if daring our opposition. Geordi looked faintly dismayed, and glanced at me for his cue. "Why not?" I said, evenly. "Lots of room, and we could do with an extra hand in the lab from time to time, and if you can cook, Miss Campbell—" "Claire, please."
Are you Michael or Mike?
Mike, always.
She smiled. I can cook, but I wouldn't want to be chief cookie. I'll spell whoever it is, though.
Geordie was on the edge of his chair and finally had his say.
Have you been to sea before, Miss, Clear?
He asked sternly.
Claire bore it equably.
Yes, Geordie, I have. For quite long trips, too. I've got all my gear, and you'll believe me when you see how worn out it all is. In fact, I'm much more familiar with what we're going to do than Pop is.
Geordie was routed.
Campbell broke in impatiently at this point.
What about the diary, Mike? You've read through it, I suppose?
There are interesting possibilities opening up.
How come?
The diary was written partly while Mark was with the IGY survey. Now he made a record of those high cobalt nodules, but the facts never came out in the open scientific record. In other words, he suppressed the evidence.
Campbell seemed perturbed.
I shouldn't think your brother would do a thing like that, he said stiffly. And that told me that any reservations he may have had about Mark stemmed from Mark's personal affiliation with Claire, and that he had never plumbed the depths of Mark's personality. I would have to be careful. But it was time to bring things out into the open.
I said, "Can you think of any other explanation?"
He shook his head.
"I'm at a loss what to make of it. I have been giving it some thought already."
Are you serious when you said your brother would do a thing like that?
He struck me as a very fine scientist.
Mark was never too scrupulous, I said. He wanted something from you, and he was showing his cleanest face.
Campbell didn't like that.
My open distrust of Mark offended his sense of fitness. Brothers should be brotherly, and blood is thicker than water. I suspected he had a strong Puritan streak in him, inherited from his, no doubt, Calvinistic ancestors. He said, almost hostilely, "There's nothing to be gained by running down your brother, especially as he can't answer back." I said softly, "You should study the Bible, Mr. Campbell. There are a few stories in the book that are very illuminating. Read about Cain and Abel, or Esau and Jacob. There's no hard and fast rule that brothers should like one another, and lots of villains have innocent kinfolk."
He was acid.
"Well, I suppose you knew him best. I never had any reason to doubt him while he was in my employ."
He caught Claire's eye and faltered just a little.
"Must admit that personally."
Claire's face was calm, showing only a polite interest, but her jawline caught my notice.
I said, "We must discuss this. We're faced with a problem put to us by Mark, and we can only solve it by understanding him and the way he worked. Geordie can support some of what I may have to tell you." I had them all riveted now. "Let me tell you something that I'll bet you don't know. Mark was kicked out of the IGY for falsifying figures. That was just before he joined your company."
"I didn't know that, and I don't think I believe it."
"It's true," I said. "Professor Jarvis, my old boss at the Institute, told me about it, and Geordie heard him too. I think he got hold of those nodules at the time, found out their value, and decided to keep the knowledge to himself. Then he moved in on you, and he was using you."
Campbell was affronted.
"Using me?
You had the money he wanted for an expedition. He couldn't show you the nodules because you'd want to know where he got them, and that was by stealing them from the people who paid his salary."
Campbell began to look baffled. "He never showed me anything. He talked a good story, though."
"Well, that's right. He had a lot of theory, and you nearly fell for it.
If you had, he'd have wasted his time and your money fossicking around the Pacific for 6 months, and then his theory would have led him to a spectacular find. You see, he knew where those nodules came from. Anyway, you'd be in the chips, and he'd be both rich and vindicated. The great scientist."
Campbell nodded unwillingly.
I said, "But something went wrong. You had your run-in with Suarez Navarro and found yourself strapped for ready funds. You couldn't finance his expedition, and so he left you flat because you were of no use to him. Isn't that so? There was silence while Campbell digested all that. All right, you've made your point. Don't drive it into the ground. Assuming something like that is possible, what do you suggest we do now? Well, first, another point. You wondered how Suarez Navarro came into the nodule hunt. I think Mark may have tried the same ploy on them. In fact, I think he and Norgard were waiting in Tahiti for the ship that's been fitted out right now, and that ties everything in squarely together. All right, let's assume that too. We're safer the more we can see into the forest, I suppose. Campbell was still shaken by what I'd said about Mark. What do we do next? Well, we could find out where Mark's IGY ship dredged and drop ours in the same places, but I don't think it will be any of the sites they actually surveyed, or this would have come out already. Mark wasn't the only one doing assays. No, I think it was a trial site, one they weren't serious about, and probably didn't even make a record of, though we could check it out. We all sat in gloom for a while. The faint drift of music changed tempo, and a woman began to sing with the trio, and I turned to watch her. Her voice was nice, but she was no world-beater. Her body was better than her voice, and set off by a revealing gown. For a moment, lost in something not at all of our troubled world, I relaxed and only caught the end of a sentence directed at me by Claire Campbell. "To ask you a question, if I'm not distracting you, Mike." Her voice was calm, but when I turned back, I saw an ironic sparkle in her eyes. "Sorry, yes?" I said. "You say that Mark was kicked off the ship for falsifying figures? But which figures? Not the high cobalt nodule assay, because, as you said, that news hasn't broken yet. So he must have falsified other figures which caught him out. What were they, and why did he cook them? Could they matter?" That was something I hadn't thought of, and it was a stopper. I said, "Mark was always a fast boy with a red herring. He cheated once in his school exams, and this is how he did it. He was called into the headmaster's office just before an exam, and the master happened to be out of the room. On the desk was a pile of question papers. Mark played it cleverly. He didn't take one, he took six. Then he made a copy for himself, and passed the six papers to other boys, anonymously." Campbell said, "I don't get it." "It's simple. He told me about it afterwards. He always knew I wouldn't tell tales. He reckoned that if the thing blew up in his face, he'd see to it that the six papers were all found in the possession of other boys. He'd be in the clear. It wasn't found out, and he got away with it. Now, what if he's done something like that here?" Campbell looked frustrated. He was supposed to be a man with acumen, after all. "I may be dumb, but I still don't get it." "Look," I said patiently. "Mark has located a deposit of high cobalt nodules, and he's busy suppressing the information. He knows that if he's found out, he's not only going in disgrace, but he's lost a potential fortune. So, knowing Mark, I'd guess that he'd toss out a few red herrings. He'd falsify some more figures to confuse the issue, and he'd probably revise all estimates upwards. It would add slightly to the risk of discovery, but if it was found out, as it evidently was, he'd be only another glory-hunting scientist, rather too optimistic and looking for professional praise. No one would suspect that one set of figures was wrong for another reason. They may not ever have caught it." I laughed humorlessly. I bet that all Mark's findings were junked anyway. None of his colleagues would trust his figures after that. "Why didn't they tell the world about it? To protect people like Pop?" asked Claire, a little bitterly. "I think they would feel that commercial folk, like your dad, can take care of themselves," I said. "They're mostly too gentlemanly." Campbell was looking at me in wonder.
Geordie in silent assent of my assessment.
"Did Mark really have a mind like that?" Campbell said. I saw that he was hurt. His pride in his judgment of men had been badly undermined, but then he'd been taken in by an expert. He had a mind that would make a corkscrew look like a straight edge. You don't have to take my word for it, either. Geordie can tell you some tales.
Geordie nodded.
Aye, the boy was a twister. He caused the family a lot of grief.
All right. Supposing that Mark was as Machiavellian as you make him out to be, it seems we're back where we started. All we have to go on is the diary.
And that's going to be a devil of a job, sorting out his scribbles. I can make a fair stab at the science, but the rest is a teaser.
We'll discuss it over dinner, Campbell decided, to my secret relief.
We chewed over the diary and the dinner together. The dinner was digestible, which was more than any of us could say for the diary. Claire asked if she could have it for bedside reading.
I like that sort of thing, she said. Puzzles, jigsaws. And I also thought that she might have felt that her own knowledge of Mark's own mind might be useful.
You're welcome, I told her. I want a break from it.
I was pleased that as the evening wore on, she seemed to lose some of her reserve, and her mouth began to lose its tight-locked caution. We were at the coffee stage when a waiter came up to the table.
"Are one of you gentlemen Mr. Trevelyan?"
"I am. There's a lady in the foyer asking to see you."
I looked around blankly.
"I don't know anyone in Panama."
Campbell looked up at the waiter.
"An old lady or a young lady?"
"Oh, a young lady, sir."
Campbell's eyes twinkled.
"If I were you, I'd be in the foyer now. What's stopping you?"
I got up. "It's probably a mistake," I said, thinking that it almost certainly wasn't.
"Excuse me."
There were several people in the foyer, including more than one young lady, but no one approached me. I crossed to the desk and said, "My name's Trevelyan. I understand someone wants me." The clerk pointed with his pen, indicating that I should come into the office behind the desk. The young lady was waiting all right, and I did know her, in a way. She was the singer who had been entertaining us in the lounge.
"I'm Trevelyan. You wanted to speak to me."
She was nervous, I could see that. She was rather slight and looked at close quarters a trifle undernourished, with hollows under her dark eyes and a skin more weathered than tanned. There was an appealing quality about her. I think the best word would be winsome. I was intrigued.
"I'm sorry to trouble you. I saw your name in the register, but I wondered if you were any relation of Mark Trevelyan from Tahiti?"
"He was my brother," I said. "I'm Michael."
"Obviously you know Mark."
I didn't know if she knew of his death, and I felt it would be unkind to throw it at her without warning.
She nodded, gripping her hands together.
"Yes, I knew him very well.
Have you just come from England?"
"Yes."
"Do you know his wife?"
"Yes."
"Did she get the suitcase I sent?"
I stared at her now.
"Well, I'm damned. I thought you were a man. So you are P. Nelson."
She smiled, and some of the tension left her.
"Yes, Paula Nelson. Then the case did arrive all right."
"It arrived, thank you," I said. I didn't say that it had been stolen immediately afterwards, because I didn't know just where this girl stood in the complexity of Mark's affairs, but I could try to find out.
"Miss Nelson, what about coming into the lounge and having a drink with me and my friends? We're all of us interested in Mark and in what he was doing out here."
She shook her head. "Oh, I couldn't do that, Mr. Trevelyan. I'm one of the hired help around here. We're not supposed to drink with the customers. The manager says this isn't a clip joint."
Her nervousness now seemed to include a fear of the manager's imminent wrath. I said gently,
"Oh, perhaps we could go somewhere else if you've the time. I would like to talk to you."
She looked at her watch.
"I could spare half an hour. Then I've got another stint in the lounge.
if you wait while I get my wrap, it'll be a pleasure."
I thought of sending a message back to the others, but decided against it. I didn't have to account to them for all my actions. We went to a small bar, a little way down the street. I bought a couple of drinks, and we settled down in an alcove. The bar was